Welcome to The Apple of Truth, a podcast that, despite our original intentions, has grown into pure Neil Gaiman appreciation.
So let us take you on a journey through everything Neil himself has ever written.
Currently, we are covering The Sandman and hope to enrich your dreams and haunt your nightmares. I'm Lena.
And I'm Vero.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 4, A Hope in Hell. Vero, did you know that this once again is a song title?
No! How do you have these facts?
Because I'm awesome. It is the title of a song from the identical named album A Hope in Hell by the band All Good Things. Let me quote from the song. "We're not gonna give up now, it's a hope in hell, one slip we die, but we'll take that chance, cause it makes us feel alive, we got a hope in hell."
Huh.
I'm pretty sure this one is a coincidence, because a hope in hell is not that rare a phrase, but it is a thing. And so I'm starting to be focused on the fact that our titles seem to coincide with song titles.
Well, it's not just one song, as a matter of fact. There is actually more than one song.
Well, you only just looked that up, so do your research on your own time, not on air.
Okay, well, I might, and we might talk about it in a little bit more detail at some point in the bonus.
We keep teasing bonus that we haven't even started to record, which is amazing. Dear Patreons, maybe we might disappoint you. It happens.
We will not we're not going to disappoint you. It's going to happen sooner or later, or it's probably going to happen later rather than sooner.
Aside from this being a coincidental reference, I have a summary for you that will also, I'm sure, tell you how I feel about this episode. Morpheus wins his helm back in hell, but fails to recover his ruby, while John gets more than lucky with his random human encounter.
That is a good summary. There's not a lot of detail. So there are some interesting things that happen in this episode, and not all of them are good. Let's put it that way. Okay, let's talk about hot things now.
Oh, well, that was difficult for me.
You have been struggling with this segment for a few episodes now. Are you still comfortable that this is something that we want to be doing?
Well, I did find something, but it's definitely not the hottest dream moment anymore, even remotely, because Morpheus in this episode is a dick, and I find nothing less sexy than an asshole.
Well, I'm not gonna lie, but the moment where we see Dream smile for the first time in 4 episodes, that was hot.
Is that the hope moment where he smiles?
Nope, it is not. Then when they first encounter Lucifer, he comes in and Lucifer starts playing games, as Lucifer does, apparently.
Oh yeah, poking fun at the use of tools.
That and a few other things that happen in that scene. And Dream seems to be enjoying that for some reason. We're going to get into details of my theories of why and what's happening there when we get to the scene. But on a few different occasions throughout that scene, you catch him smiling. And this is something so unexpected to me. And I feel like it was a bit of an evil smile. And I kind of find it a little hot. And by a little, I mean a lot.
Okay. To me, it was more a smirk. And I think that's why it wasn't hot for me. The problem is he starts being off very exposition heavy, which I never enjoy. And then he's a dick because then Nana happens. And I hate everything about this. And afterwards, I'm just very whelmed by everything. So nothing Dream does in this episode was even remotely hot to me. But that is no problem because we meet a comic accurate Mazikeen. And she is gorgeous and she is perfect and she is hot. So
that got me so excited.
Everything about my comic, at least visually comic accurate, because she still talks understandably, which not correct, but visually comic accurate Mazikeen, everything about her is hot. So she is my hottest moment, aka person.
I like that though.
Yeah, no, I really love that.
As per usual, this segment reveals a lot about ourselves.
Oh, a grumpy man smiles. Oh, sorry.
A hot woman appears.
Yes, I am very, very simple. Woman, hot.
I'm sorry, hot woman in leathers and chains. Let's be accurate here.
Yes, perfect. And also accurate to the source material, which always gives me the extra fan boner. And I mean, what more do I want?
You want to tell me some facts and funs. That's what you want.
That was a perfect segue. So we're still stuck with director Jamie Childs, skipping over that. We get a new writer. We get writer Austin Guzman, who mostly wrote for Grey's Anatomy before, for which he also was a co-producer, just like he is for this season of Sandman.
That explains the amount of angst and drama in this episode.
I have never watched Grey's Anatomy and I have zero interest.
It brings me joy, but only sometimes. And nothing past season 14.
Fun facts. I also put some into the episode itself. The much-loved Lucifer from 2015 Morningstar, as played by Tom Ellis and loosely based on the works of Neil Gaiman, does not appear in this series, with Gaiman stating of Ellis' interpretation, I quote, "He is so lovable, he is so wonderful. You love him so much that you couldn't sell the world on Tom's Lucifer as being a genuine threat, because you'd go, ah, he'd get them all wound up, and then they go for a drink." But he continued hoping for a multiverse crossover where Ellis and Gwendoline Christie, the Lucifer in this episode, get to meet.
Maybe that should be the Lucifer movie that the Lucifer showrunners keep talking about.
Oh yeah, that would be absolutely wonderful. But I love Gaiman's description of Tom Ellis's Lucifer because it is very accurate.
It is, absolutely. I think we both came to absolutely love Tom's version of Lucifer.
Yeah, but also he is a big puppy in a certain kind of way, and Gwendoline Christie's Lucifer definitely is not a puppy.
Not a puppy.
Then, of course, I already explained the title reference. And lastly, one form Lucifer takes in their duel is that of anti-life, the end of everything. Throughout the Silver Age and into the modern age of DC Comics, the anti-life equation has been sought by Darkseid, the Great Darkness, as a means to end the chaos of free will and bring all living things under his dominion.
And that answers one of my questions during the episode. Thank you very much.
Good. I am here for that. I have many interesting things throughout the episode. We shall see how many of them stay in. But that concludes my facts and funs.
And here we go with our previously on the Sandman. Dream has been imprisoned and robbed by a mortal, but has since managed to escape. He learned a vague location of his items of power and managed to retrieve his sand. Lucien forced a raven on him to keep him company, and they're now on their way to hell to find his helmet. Meanwhile, his ruby is stashed away by John, who stole it from his mother and is very much not okay mentally.
Yeah, to say John is very much not okay is, I think, one of the best lines ever. I think somewhere down the line, I have that his moral compass is somewhat broken, which I think is also along this line.
Yep, there is. The boy has troubles. He really does need help.
The boy has issues. Yes, very much so. Okay, perfect. We open this episode in hell, which I did not expect us to be straight into it. Hi, here we are, hell. The problem I have with this scene is that we already get quite a bit of exposition, and the beginning of the, I think, first three hell scenes is pure exposition. And because I know bits of the comic, and because we have covered Lucifer, the TV show, and because I have a certain knowledge about hells, I was very quickly very bored. And not even Tom Sturridge's voice, which, do not get me wrong, is still smooth honey in my ears, can save that.
I was not struggling right now because there are still things that I enjoyed looking at.
Oh yeah, visually this entire episode in hell is amazing. I am not ever shitting on the visual presentation of this episode. Please do not misunderstand me.
When it comes to composition and setup, the second we start the scene that's a little bit later in the forest, that's where my breaking point was. I was okay kind of following this. I wasn't super following everything that was happening there because, I'm sorry, it was a little confusing at the beginning here because Matthew is like, oh, it really exists. And Dream goes, well, for some. And I'm like, what do you mean? Matthew goes like, well, so it does it only exist for the people who believe in it? And I'm like, okay, I cannot get behind that. I understand that. And then Dream goes, well, did you believe it when you were a human?
Which is not an answer.
Absolutely not an answer. Fuck that.
This question needs to go on the list because I want an answer for this from Neil himself.
Yeah, it's completely confusing because first of all, he doesn't answer the question. He only answers with another question asking Matthew if he believed it and Matthew saying, oh yes, I did. But like, why is he then surprised that it exists? If he actually believed in it.
Because he believed, he didn't know. Because believing and knowing are polar opposites.
I hate it. I did not like this conversation.
There was another tiny tidbit that I didn't like because I am me. And that is when Dream counts down several names, which are Avernus, Tartarus, Hades, the infernal region you call Hell. Avernus is only the entry to Hell, not Hell itself. And all other names are Hell. So I don't like that. Either call it the entrance to Hell or call it Hell. Don't mix shit.
I would like to point out that my autocorrect changed Avernus to Avenue, which tracks.
Yeah, basically. But as much also as I'm going to shit on Matthew during this episode, they did give him some really funny lines. For example, they make you bring your own fire to hell was hilarious.
Is there anything in any of the forms of hell that we have seen in mythology that would talk about you bringing your own punishment?
Well, this is more reminiscent for me of the Lucifer TV show Hell, where your own guilt creates your own punishment.
Yeah, that's a very good allegory between the two shows, actually. I like that.
And with this, we leave Hell and we go to New York, where a very lost John is crossing a street on a crossing. He is on a crossing. You can clearly see it on the asphalt, and still he is nearly being run over. So, in my opinion, the asshole that nearly runs him over is at fault for all the shit that happens to poor Rosemary from here on out. Because she only stops because John gets nearly run over by another asshole.
Yes, but what was the light like? Did he try to cross on red light?
Doesn't matter. It's a crossing.
I know. Okay.
Fuck that driver.
I'm just saying, I have been driven around by a friend around New York and they do not give a fuck unless the walking light is green. They don't give a fuck if there is a crossing or not.
Yeah, they should. Fuck the driver. Poor Rosemary. I go on record, I love Rosemary. She's my favorite thing about this entire episode.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Okay, so let's just start off with the fact that John is giving me the most anxiety ever because I know that he is not right. And the thing is, if you watch some, even if you watch the Corinthian, if you watch some evil villain in any story, you get to understand the agenda and you understand where this is going because you can kind of guess what's going to happen because there is a logic behind this. But John does not have that logic in his behavior.
He is not of sound mind.
Yeah, he has his own logic in his own brain that we do not understand. And this is why I'm so anxious every time I watch him because
I enjoy that so much. He's giving me all the tension without even doing anything. He's just there and I'm nervous.
Mm-hmm. I hate it. Thank you. I'm nervous enough in my entire life.
I love it. And so when the yet unnamed Rosemary leaves her car and then offers him a ride, I was like, oh no, oh no.
No, the good lady
is helping her and she will regret it. I am so sure of it. And then we pan into the car and we see she has a Rottweiler. She has a proper dog. And I had like a glimmer of hope for her. But then throughout the episode, Susie, the Rottweiler, is just the sweetest puppy ever. So, yeah, sadly, no protection. But also good, because if Susie did anything too early, she would just explode inside out. So, yay.
Yeah. Well, I was 100% convinced that Susie was going to die because I fell in love with her.
Aww.
And this is the experience I've had with this fucking show so far, is that every time I fall in love for any creature or any being, they dead by the end of the episode. So I am shocked that this is not the case.
A lot of things in this episode I did not see coming, especially when it comes to Rosemary and Susie, which it's nice to be surprised.
Yeah, indeed. So before we move on to the next scene, do you know the actor for Rosemary?
No, but I also didn't look her up. I did not recognize her. Should I have recognized her?
I don't think so, because I don't think you've seen this, but she was very familiar to me. So I did a very fast Google search because I was very sure she was not American, because not to shit on Sarah Niles, which is her name, her American accent is not very good. She is in Ted Lasso.
I have not watched that, indeed. I need to watch that. It's high on my list.
She is a very good character in Ted Lasso. You will enjoy her.
I'm pretty sure Anthony Stewart Head has a role in Ted Lasso at some point during a dart tournament.
There is, yeah, Anthony Head is in Ted Lasso.
I need to watch it. I shall watch it. So I am looking forward to that. With John getting in the car, we leave New York and go back to hell. And here's a line that spoke to my German heart. There are rules, protocols, which must be followed.
Yeah, this is getting a little heavier on exposition, which is already what you have mentioned, but it's still acceptable to me at this point because I feel like we are still moving the story a little bit by using the exposition. It's not just a random information dump just yet. At least it felt that way to me right now. But let's just talk for a second about the visuals.
Oh yeah, the living walls of damned souls. Even in the tiniest background, you see them moving. It is so well done.
It is beautiful. It feels very Greek to me.
Yes, definitely. This is summoning Greek associations of torture. This is Dante's Inferno. Like, this is the classic Roman Greek tragedy, how we imagine hell and suffering.
And then Dream rings the gong and we get this poem from Squatterbloat.
What a name.
There's one door at the gate of damnation. Is it thief, thug, or whore? There's one at the door. There's room for one more at the gate of damnation. I have Googled this because it felt very pertinent. And very quickly, I found a couple of references where these words are marked as being something you can only understand if you read the comics. So it is directly lifted from the comic books. So as somebody who hasn't read those yet, I unfortunately don't have the context to it. But it is very curious and it's very fun. And it just brings me a lot of joy.
The poem basically just leads to the question for me, as an obvious question, if there is a gate of damnation, are there other gates as well?
Obviously.
And what are their names?
Well, the main gate, the back door.
That would have been exposition I'd enjoy, you know? Because why is Morpheus choosing the gate of damnation to enter hell?
I presumed, for some reason, I don't know why, that this is the gate he needs to go through if he wants to be invited as a king of another realm. This is a choice for him. Or is it the same gate that the other ones went through?
Yeah, this is where all the tortured souls go through.
Well, in that case, it must be because it was convenient because they followed the souls to this specific gate and it doesn't really matter to him which gate he's going to use because he needs to be invited in anyway.
See, here I was thinking that he was aware of what the stakes of the game were going to be, which if he lost was going to be his internal damnation, and that is why he enters through the gate of damnation.
So would you call him a thief, thug, or a whore?
I am pretty sure he is a whore. I am confident he is a thief, and the way he behaves towards Nana, he is also a thug.
Oh, someone salty. We'll get to it.
Oh yeah, and it's not even that far away.
Now, in this setting, even next to the demon, Morpheus feels very small, which is something new to us.
Yes.
Because thus far, all the situations we've seen him, he's been very large, very tallest, biggest, most powerful creature in the room. And this is a very different dynamic, so I am really enjoying that.
That is really well done, but it also makes his behavior seem like these tiny rat dogs that behave like big dogs.
I don't know, he is very bold.
Yeah, bordering on rude.
Yes, but also I understand why he has this attitude, because if he didn't, what if they call him out, you know? What if they tell him, oh, prove yourself then?
Yeah. Of course he's grandstanding, but I still do not like that. I would not like that from anyone. But he gets finally allowed to enter by the ginormous fucking demon. Like, that dude just towers over him.
Squatter blow.
It's amazing.
Squatter blow.
And since we covered 6th season of Lucifer, and we did get a fair amount of hell in that TV show, I really have to say that this hell is so much more creepy and scary than the hell we were shown. Even though the Lucifer TV show hell was personalized terror. This is, in lack of other terms, standardized torture. So actually more boring, but somehow it comes across as more terrifying to me because everything is so bleak and seemingly empty of hope.
But that's the thing, because the whole concept of hell in Lucifer is that you can find your way out because it's personalized to you.
But you can find your way out of hell in this universe as well. Like in The Sandman, that is how hell works.
Well, I wasn't aware of that when I started this thought, so whatever.
Sorry. As far as I'm aware.
By depicting it as there not being any dreams or hopes, they're trying to make it so that you don't matter.
Yeah, it seems hopeless and desolate and endless. Ha ha ha.
And so this is why I actually really like this, and I find it a lot more terrifying, because what is more terrifying than losing yourself and your self-identity? And, you know, there's nowhere to go. You are nothing. You're a blank page. So, you know, which is worse? Personalized torture, or you don't exist anymore, essentially?
The last thing I was wondering about, Dream calls the demon by name, and then the demon goes like, oh, who's this? And since he then makes fun of him for not having his helm or his ruby, I'm pretty sure he knows who he is. So he must have been taking the piss, asking, well, who is this? And not actually not knowing the name, right? Okay, good. Just as long as I got that.
No. It feels very clearly that everybody knows that he's coming and who he is. And they all know why he's there. And therefore, they all know that he is weakened and not his regular power level.
He's not his best self right now.
He really is not, is he?
No. We pop back to New York before we get into the worst hell scene yet. And yes, here I wrote down, John makes me very nervous around normal people.
He is giving old helpless man vibes in this point, at the beginning of the scene, before he gets into the whole
arson and murder.
Yeah, so he comes off as a regular poor old guy who got lost from the retirement home where he lives, and he doesn't have his marbles collected, so he can't find his way back, so he's looking for places where he used to live. That's the vibe that I'm getting, and that's the vibe Rosemary is getting. And then it turns on a dime like nothing, and it's so fast, and it's so creepy, and I hate it.
Also, did you notice, because obviously this is filmed in a not moving car, did you notice that Rosemary barely looks at the road? It annoyed the shit out of me. She mostly focuses on the middle mirror to look at John. And given the fact that she's driving on a highway, she should be looking constantly on the road and only sometimes flicking her eyes up. And I'm a sucker for shit details like that, so that I did not enjoy.
This is a trope that is used in so many TV shows and movies, and I hate it. I am so sensitive to it as well, because just look at the fucking road. Look at the road. You're gonna die. You're gonna kill your beautiful baby dog.
Exactly. So that was the one moment where Rosemary was like losing brownie points with me. But she is so fucking lovely and understanding and everything that I can't stay mad at her for too long.
And then John is like, oh, and you are a mother yourself, because she's like, oh, I'm sure your mother loved you. And he's like, oh, you've spoken like a mother yourself. And I was like, oh no, the poor future orphans. This is terrible.
Yeah, and then he goes, of course, on to mention that he was locked away for arson and murder, among other things. And that is the moment poor Rosemary has a small facial reaction, but she keeps a tight control on her emotions. And from that moment onward, I love her.
She is a lot. She's good. She's good at what she's trying to do. She's not good enough.
Oh no, she's amazing. I love her. She is doing everything right, given the fact that she is not aware of the supernatural.
Well, in this scene, John proves himself to have the biggest fucking chip on his shoulder in history of chips on shoulders, Because literally when Rosemary said it is the most terrible thing to do to a human is to lie to them, and he says, I am the living example of that. And I'm like, you are, Oh, that's so obnoxious. You made choices, my man. You made choices. I understand that they were not 100% in your control and that there's supernatural involved, but you made choices. Goodbye.
Oh, yes.
Anyway.
But he was also lied to, and he did not take it well.
Clearly.
And for a fact, he does not lie. During this entire episode, once again, John does not lie. And I am here for it.
Okay, that's the one not terrible thing about him, I suppose. Alas, there is a moment when I'm going to disagree with you very slightly. Not in the fact that he doesn't lie, but in the fact that he doesn't always mean what he says. But we're going to get to that a little bit later.
Yeah, but he's basically like Lucifer Morningstar in the TV show Lucifer, with the you can omit things and la 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 la, you can be a bit creative. But he doesn't outright lie because of his position when it comes to lies, because of his personal opinion when it comes to lies. And I am here for that. But yeah, this is also the scene where I wrote down that John's moral compass is a bit fucked.
A little bit. Let's go to the worst scene of this episode. Let's fly through it real fast. The only information that I took from this scene that I found interesting was the fact that he establishes Lucifer Morningstar as the second most powerful being after the Creator. There's two details that I love about this. First is that Lucifer is the second most powerful being, and second, the Creator. I want to know more about the Creator. Are they still around? Are they in charge of things, or did they just make it and run away? What's going on there? Please tell me, not don't tell me. No spoilers.
As I said, this is the worst scene when it comes to exposition, because we have Lucifer Morningstar, aka Samael, aka the most powerful of all the angels, aka the second most powerful creature there is, aside from the Creator. Yes, we get it. There's backstory.
I'm already asleep.
I was not here for that. But to me, the scene contains a much more relevant information than Lucifer Morningstar being the second most powerful creature in creation.
Mm-hmm.
Morpheus is in love.
Because we're going through the trees, and this is the scene that I fucking hate, because it's literally just information dump and nothing else.
Oh, I just keep everything when we are in hell is for me one scene, sorry. When we go to the tower, that for you is another scene.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. We are now at the tower.
We're now at the tower, and Squatterbloat is the worst.
I love him.
I do love him, but I fucking hate him. You know how it is. And we have an interaction.
We go past an open window with some spikes in there. And the moment Morpheus passes that window, a female voice says, "Kai cool." And Morpheus instantly recognizes either the name or the voice or both. And so obviously I had to look it up. And Kai cool is a fictionalized name. Gaiman used this character as an amalgam of many African culture variants for gods, according to the DC comic wiki.
It is a name that my Google spell corrected when I misspelled it when I was writing down my notes. So it is apparently well known enough for my Google autocorrect. But this interaction is interesting to me on a few levels. Because first of all, he looks different when he talks to her.
Yes, because his human form is not real. The way you perceive dream depends on who you are and how you were taught and what you believe. He's a construct. That is the word I was looking for.
And this is what I find really interesting on a philosophical level, because we can then start talking about, yes, he is played by Tom Sturridge, but is he looking like this for everybody? I mean, yes, obviously he does, because this is the way he has been cast. But on the psychological level, why does he look this way right now to us and all of that? I find it really interesting, and I have not given it a lot of thought, but it's just because I didn't want to fall into the pit of philosophical despair, but with something that I would be very excited to have a conversation about.
Well, take a note and maybe put it in the summoning. But basically, it is an example how humans or slash souls, because we are in hell, so right now it's not humans, it's human souls, perceive dream. He might not just look different to different backgrounds, like depending on how you grew up, but basically every single person might perceive him slightly different. And someone who did not grow up like you with the Sandman might perceive him very differently than someone who has a preset image for him in their minds. Like, to me, before I read the comics, the Sandman would have looked like the fucking Sandman from my children's show, which is a tiny, cute old man with a white beard and, like, these sleeping hat thingies, you know? Very adorable.
Like a dwarf from the Snow White and Seven Dwarfs.
A bit, but more grandpa-like, less dwarf-like.
Okay. That is interesting. I would love to see who would show up for me. Going into myself and trying to figure it out would be interesting.
Yeah. And then, of course, we have the actual conversation between the two of them. And we end this conversation with that she loves him. Yes, he still loves her, but he has not forgiven her after 10,000 years. And so, obviously, I go into the Google search before we get to the next scene where we get a partial answer. And so, here you get the full background. Because I read this and then I continued watching the episode, and that is why I keep shitting on Dream, because he's a dick. And after you hear this, you will agree. 10,000 years ago, Dream and Nada were briefly in love. Nada was the queen of an African tribe known as the First People. One night, Nada glimpsed a man cloaked in darkness walking through her city and stopping beneath her tower. Nada fell instantly in love, and she used magic to learn that the mysterious stranger was Dream of the Endless. Nada's magic allowed her to enter the Dreaming to profess her love to the Dream Lord, whom her people called Kaikul. Dream fell in love with Nada, but knowing that a mortal loving one of the Endless is forbidden, she rejected him. Still, Kaikul pursued her until they made love, but true to the warnings, Nada's city was instantly destroyed. Because she committed a sin, Nada killed herself, but Dream pursued her in the afterlife and asked her to be his queen. When Nada rejected him several more times, Kaikul was angered and banished Nada to hell, where she remained for 10,000 years. In Dream's mind, Nada betrayed him and their love, which he can't forgive. But Nada rejected Kaikul because their love was not meant to be, and her people were punished for her mistake. Fuck you, Morpheus. Fuck you. There is no reason for Nada to be in fucking hell.
Well, we've touched upon this a couple of times in the previous episodes. He is a man.
Yeah.
He is not human, but he is a man.
But he's not. That's the thing. Like, he presents as a man and everything. But, like, human male bullshittery is not acceptable for one of the Endless. And with this backstory, fuck you, Morpheus. I have no understanding for this. I am sorry. And there is no apology for it.
The thing he says in the next scene, he says, "She defied me." And that is enough. I didn't need to even know the backstory that you just told me. To me, that is not love. That is obsession.
Yeah, and I'm upset with him.
He thought he loved her. He still thinks that he loves her. But in fact, he is obsessed with her, and he's obsessed with the fact that he cannot have her, which is very godlike.
Blah, I hate it. I hate it.
It's terrible. It's patriarchy on the highest level, but...
It's disgusting.
It's bad. It's really, really bad. But I was surprised by the fact that he laughs in this scene. I was not surprised by the fact that he petty. In the next scene, I was like, oh, he don't laugh. I get it now. No reason to be surprised. He doesn't understand what love is, because love is selfless. If he truly loved her, he would have let her go.
And he would have respected her saying no.
Yeah, the same way Lucifer Morningstar in the TV show Lucifer wanted to let Chloe go because he truly loved her.
Yes. So, fuck Morpheus. I'm sorry.
So we're back in the car, and I was so done with this storyline in the sense because...
Oh God, I love it.
The thing is, I was just waiting for shit to go down, and I was more and more anxious about John because he just creates excuses. He is...
He is the victim of his own story.
He is the biggest victim of all the victims. He is the victim with a capital V.
Yeah, for himself.
Yeah. Like the world's smallest violin playing. I can hear that. Poor little baby. Your mom loved you so much she wanted to keep you safe and keep you alive.
No, but he also is very accurate in the whole humans are fundamentally selfish, because he is talking about himself as well. He is fundamentally selfish, and he is aware of that.
Well, yes, he is selfish, but that's not why people lie. I think that Rosemary is a lot better at pinpointing why people lie.
I think both is true at the same time and at the same amount. People lie for selfish reasons, and and people lie because they're scared. And sometimes they are selfish and scared at the same time.
Well, she says literally they will say anything, do anything to keep themselves from being hurt, which is fundamentally selfish.
Exactly.
But they're doing it out of fear.
Yes, but to not be scared and not be hurt is selfish when you are willing to hurt or scare other people around you, when your own well-being and happiness and comfort grates or lands above everyone else around you. So I am with both of them. They just have a different angle on how they view the reason and motivation behind lying. And I also think that they are both missing many relevant points for lying. But I think those two are big reasons, because many other reasons would fall into one of those two categories. So I really like this. And also, this is the scene where John refers to himself as doing morally ambiguous stuff, which, John, honey, yes.
No, I can't. And I find it fascinating that this is the moment when Rosemary starts lying to him.
Yes.
The moment they talk about the importance of being honest and how much he hates lying, she starts lying to him.
Yes, because she needs to.
Because at this point, she is scared out of her mind. And as she says,
people lie when they're afraid.
Exactly.
Yes, yes. Good point.
Now, let's go back to the oversharer.
Yeah, I really need Matthew to not be a thing. He is getting on my nerves so fucking much this entire episode. I really need him to be not a thing.
I didn't mind him at one point, and one point only. This is not that point.
I hope it's not the pep talk he delivers to Dream.
It's not what he says specifically.
Oh, the pure fact that fucking stupid Matthew is the one talking Dream out of a stupor is completely bullshit to me. So, yeah. Okay, we're gonna talk about that when it happens. I need Matthew to not be a thing, period.
I understand that Matthew is put in there as a representation of us as the audience, because he is asking the questions that apparently the audience needs answered, like, who was Nada? Who is Lucifer? Wait, shit, do you mean Lucifer the devil?
Yeah, it's like, thank you, I'm not that brain dead, you know? So we get the she defied me line, which is, that you're a dick, fuck off. And then we reach the door.
And we also get the reasoning behind why we had Nada. It is because Lucifer is letting Dream know that Hell was expecting them. This is all prepared.
Yeah, this is all deliberate.
So, you know, interesting tidbit. By the way, there's a lot of walking in Hell.
Yeah, because walking sucks for most people.
And also, as much as visually this is so beautiful, and it's something that is used on so many, especially fantasy TV shows or movies, the super tall, narrow gates make zero sense. And especially here, where Dream walks through them and we have this beautiful, like, him walking in and the flying raven above him in the sliver of light. It's stunning. Don't get me wrong. But then he walks inside and he's in a cave. And I'm like, why do you have such fucking tall door if there's a cave inside where you can literally touch the ceiling?
Because it looks cool and everything in Hell looks the way Lucifer wants it to look.
Style over substance.
Yeah, form over function.
Ugh, I hate it.
We walk to the door and the door is a ginormous pentagram that when opening suddenly starts bleeding, including ground. I was like, okay, this Lucifer is even more of a drama queen than Tom Ellis's Lucifer.
Yeah, everything needs to be just so. It's scary, but like not scary enough, but also scary enough to be gross and kind of what you expect, but not really, because
certain cliches need to be fulfilled, you know? We go in and the entire demeanor and presentation and behavior of Lucifer, to me, gives off a vibe that this Lucifer has much more embraced their purpose compared to our Lucifer in Six Seasons. Even when Lucifer went back to Hell to do his duty to protect Chloe, he never came across as embracing his duty in the same acceptance and indulgence, I'm gonna say, that this Lucifer does. Which, curious.
I feel, due to something that we're gonna get later on, there is a certain level of acceptance, but it's not a full acceptance. However, there is a lot of embracement. It feels like this version of Lucifer Morningstar is making the best out of a bad situation. Let's put it that way.
I think it's more than just that. Like, a proper embracing is more than just making the best out of a shit situation. I think she enjoys it.
Yeah, either way, this is an incredible scene, incredible dance. Both Dream and Lucifer seem to be enjoying this situation on a certain level.
Well,
Lucifer is my new fave. I'm just going to put it out there. I hope it doesn't mean certain death yet.
Do you really think Lucifer Morningstar would die like that?
I wish not. I'd hope not. But also, I do not trust Neil Gaiman, like, at all.
I mean, I do, because when has he ever led us wrong? Aside from Lucifer, we also get a comic accurate Mezukiin, as I have said in the intro of this episode. You say they both seem to enjoy their interaction and conversation here, Lucifer and Dream. To me, Lucifer is so wonderfully condescending when talking to Dream with sweet Morpheus. If only it were that easy. Roots and protocols, which is a direct quote to what Morpheus said when entering, which is 100% deliberate. So Lucifer was listening. And I do not think that Morpheus enjoys being talked to like a child.
I think that Dream enjoys the fact that Lucifer is being so fucking condescending because they don't think that he has any of his items back. That there is no power at all, and he feels that he has, like, a secret in his sleeve.
I'm pretty sure that Lucifer is aware that he has his sand back, because it would fit the way Lucifer is being portrayed here. To be basically all-knowing, it seems.
Seems like it.
Even though it was so fucking funny when Lucifer was poking fun at Dream using tools, and as a response, Dream pulls out one of his tools. It's like, quod erat demonstrandum, bitch. You are dependent on your tools.
Yeah. Well, this is all in a situation where Lucifer first summons all the demons because better bitch.
Oh god, yes. Should we question them one by one?
What would you like to do?
Oh.
It's excellent. It's delicious. I love that. I just really enjoyed that moment and that whole speech about the tools. So we know how you relied upon your tools, but tools are the subtlest of traps. We became reliant on them, and in their absence, we are vulnerable, weak, defenseless. Staring Dream down. And Lucifer is trying to goad him, but I want to talk about this for a second, about this sentence, because this gives me, he didn't always have these tools. He has become dependent on them over time, so he can be without them.
No, he used to be able to be without them. Now that he has created them, he has become dependent on them, and without them, he is weak and defenseless.
I don't know. I think he could track back. It probably wouldn't happen immediately, but I feel he would track back to not needing them anymore.
He probably would have to reabsorb them like he reabsorbed Gregory.
We don't talk about it. It didn't happen.
We don't talk about Gregory. We don't talk about Gregory.
No.
What? It was a proof of concept, and I'm pretty sure if he ever decides to be not dependent on his tools anymore, he is going to have to go through a similar process. And he probably will not have the same easy time to reabsorb them.
We'll see how this goes. This is a sentence that gave me an option to question certain things.
Put it on the list. Can Dream regain full power without his free items? Or without reabsorbing his free items? Because I say hell no. Before we continue with the summoning of the specific demon and everything, I just want to say I hate the white outfit on Lucifer. I love the black fighting outfit, but the white outfit is shite. Seriously, it's so bad. I hate the cut, I hate the color, I hate the style, I hate everything about the white outfit.
I feel like Lucifer is trying to embody a certain emotion.
Oh, we're going to talk about emotion because yeah.
It feels very much like, we are so innocent. look at us. We are all in white. We have our blonde curls and everything. We are the most innocent creature alive. And maybe a little condescending, and maybe the second strongest creature after the creator, whatever. But the embodiment of the white, that the white is symbolic, has to be.
Yeah, you could also do white and not do such a badly cut and unflattering shit on poor Gwendolyn's body.
Well, maybe it was to be telling that innocence doesn't really suit Lucifer.
I don't know. I just hated it. This is the best theory so far. Yes, but I really hated it. Black outfit is amazing. And it's not that different. That's the thing. Like, it's not even that different, but it looks so much better.
What I really love about the end of this scene is that Dream is using one of his items to locate the next. And I think that works really, really well because they clearly are connected.
And at the end, we do the same with the helm and the ruby. So he uses his sand to summon Corazon. And obviously, when a weird demon name is dropped, I have to Google it. And I did. And so, a strap in. Corazon is a demon or devil that originated within writing with the two 16th century occultists Edward Kelly and John Dee within the letters occult system of Enochian magic. In the 20th century, the spiritual dark entity became an important element within the mystical system of Thelema, founded by notorious occultist Aleister Crowley, where he is the dweller in the abyss, believed to be the last great obstacle between the adept and the enlightenment. Thelemites believe that if he is met with proper preparation, then his function is to destroy the ego, which allows the adept to move beyond the abyss of occult cosmology.
I wonder who needs to let go of his ego.
Yes, definitely. Big fan of this background. Big fan of this whole thing that from now onward happens in the comics. Not a fan of what happens in the show.
Interesting. So this entire situation, Corazon gets summoned. He is obviously holding the helm and he is being challenged. He says, "This is mine. I traded it fair and square. It belongs to me. I'm completely with him."
Yeah, exactly.
I don't see any specific reasons why he should give the helm up with no fight.
Yeah, and or with nothing in return. If Dream was offering anything for the fucking helm, you know?
Yeah, not that he has anything.
He could offer a future boon.
A future what?
A boon, a favor.
Oh, huh. I mean, he could, but then he would owe a favor to a demon, and that's never a good thing. Especially to somebody so high and mighty like Dream.
Yeah, true. I don't blame Corazon.
But obviously this is a gigantic setup that Dream just happily walks into. Even Mace smiles when Dream says, "I want to challenge you for the helm." Because clearly he's doing exactly what they expected him to do. So then they obviously proceed with the plan where Dream, of course, does what Dream does and says he's going to fight for himself. And then, of course, Corazon chooses Lucifer to be a champion for him. And there was a moment on Morpheus' face. He seems to me unhappy about the outcome, but not surprised, which is respect. I think he hoped this wouldn't happen, but he didn't expect it to not happen.
The thing is, Corazon in the comics isn't that smart, and Corazon and Dream fight each other. And that makes the entire thing that happens afterward so much more believable, because Corazon is not the second most powerful being in the universe. And that is why I have such problems with big parts of this episode.
Yeah, it feels a lot more achievable. I think that they wanted to make the stakes as high as possible, which...
Yes, but in turn, they made Lucifer come across as incompetent and weak. And I do not like that.
I wouldn't call it that strongly, but yeah.
We're going to talk about that in the next hell scene. But before we go there, I have to mention the incredible smooth outfit change of Lucifer the moment Lord Lucifer is named champion of Corazon. Because literally, you see Lucifer walking and it's like in the first second, white and then black. And I'm like, yes.
The amazing moment when this happens and Lucifer goes, "Oh no, how terrible, please." And I am literally seeing that gif with Gene Wilder from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, from the old one, when he goes, "Oh no, please come back, don't go." And this is exactly the same vibe. oh no, I can't say no. How terrible. The rules.
Yeah, rules and protocols, as Lucifer stated earlier. I also want to say, it is a really smart fucking move from Coruscant. And I like Coruscant being smart, but it doesn't fit with how he behaves later. And so, this is another inconsistency for me.
The thing is, I don't think this is Coruscant's idea. This is what I mean. I think this was a whole thing, was set up. I think this is actually Lucifer's idea. And that's why Lucifer is so pleased with the outcome, because it's going exactly as planned.
Then I'm going to talk about this here instead of later. My main problem with Gwendolyn Christie as Lucifer is that I do not enjoy her face acting, because most of the time she portrays Lucifer as being completely in control of every situation, but her face constantly gives hints as uneasiness, nervousness, tension, everything. And it does not make sense. Either Lucifer is the fucking second most powerful in the entire fucking universe, and then there is no reason for nervousness and tension and tiny twitchy movements in your face. Either all of this is an elaborate plan, and Lucifer is the one in power, also planning to lose, by the way, because otherwise there would be no fucking reason for Lucifer to lose. Or it's really badly done. And this is why I don't like it. Visually, Gwendolyn works for me as Lucifer, but this portrayal of Lucifer, this arrogant, powerful, mightier-than-thou creature, would have more control over the involuntary facial expressions, over the millennia of ruling over demons. And that is something I do not like. And I don't think that it was an accident. I think it's a deliberate decision, and I do not understand it.
I wonder if this is a deliberate decision by Morningstar as well, then.
Makes no sense to me. That's the thing. Nothing of this makes any sense to me, which is why I don't like it. If it made sense, I would understand, and then I couldn't, like, ratified in my brain. But none of this makes any sense. I don't even understand why we went with Lucifer fighting Dream personally after explicitly stating Lucifer is the second most powerful being.
I think that's basically just the stakes being as high as possible.
Yeah, but the stakes aren't high if it's like, oh, this is a super powerful creature. Oh, look, they lost. It just makes it ridiculous.
I think there is a reason why Lucifer loses, but
it has to be deliberate.
Let's get into those things with the challenge and when we actually see that.
This is why I'm not going with you on your theories, because if Gwendolyn played Lucifer with a calm face, I would be with you on most of the theories that you have so far formulated. But because more often than not, you have these lip and chin twitches, I am not.
It's fair enough. Let's talk about John for a minute, because let's get through the scene really fast, because I hate it, or you just take over.
I love this scene because it is the most tense yet of all the John scenes, which I am here for it. Yes, sorry. That is who I am.
See, here I knew what was going to happen. So the anxiousness and tenseness that I had up until now, I was like, yeah, no.
And it's beautiful. And so obviously we have Rosemary going inside, John joining her after first saying, oh no, I'm fine. Being in the shop or in the gas station with her and everything. I love everything about this.
Do you think that he went into the shop because she was behaving off, or did he actually want to check out the drinks?
I think both. I think that he genuinely believes every human is selfish, so obviously he needed to be there. But I also think genuinely he wanted to have a look around, because in the end he just picks water, if you see what drink he has in his hand. I love everything about this, because they go inside, she goes like, oh, it's my treat, have a look around. And she goes to the dude behind the till and she whispers to him, but he's wearing wireless headphones, or even wire headphones, but he's having headphones, and so he literally cannot hear her. So she goes like, you need you to call 911 for me. And he goes like, taking out the earphone, say what now? It's like really loud. And she's like, da-da-da-da-da. It is so funny to me, because like she's doing everything right. And then the dude even calls 911. But because he's a fucking idiot, he doesn't really lower his voice, which, I mean, John was already aware of what was happening, but given the situation, if you call fucking 911, maybe don't basically shout into the phone, you know, when there's like scary person there.
I think that that part could have been very easily avoided if they didn't do the call while they were still inside.
What else should they have been doing? Call the police when she's back in the car?
Yes, he could have easily taken the make and model of the car.
Then Rosemary would have needed to tell that dude that, because he didn't come across as that quick on the uptake. So not an actual workable solution. And so obviously John had, in my opinion, high hopes for Rosemary. So he actually removes her from the scene by putting her behind him.
Well, he actually wants to leave, and he is planning on leaving until the gun gets pulled.
Yes, but the point is he puts her furthest away from everything, which I appreciate. Yes, John is a horrible maniac, and he is not hesitant about basically making people kill themselves, but he seems genuinely appreciative of Rosemary, which I like.
He also needs somebody to drive him to the Ruby.
Well, yeah, I mean, he would somehow work it out, probably. He turns around, we get the whole gun situation and everything, and once again, technically, he does not kill the man kills himself by accident.
To me, it wasn't as tense because I knew exactly what was going to happen here.
So did you not have the expectation that he was going to kill Rosemary? Because that is what the scene gave me vibes of in the beginning.
I knew someone's going to die. I think it's not likely going to be Rosemary because I don't think John knows how to drive and he needs her. But there was a certain intent to this scene for the first time from all the John scenes. So less anxiety, more fear, if you know what I mean.
More surety now. The shit-if is going to hit-if the fan-if. We go inside the gas station after a short back and forth where John first is like, no, I don't need anything, and then actually goes inside. If he's actually really looking at the sodas or not seems kind of unlikely, since he does leave the gas station with a bottle of water. And I'm pretty sure he had water in the psychiatric hospital. Prison, whatever, thingy. And while we have the interaction in the gas station, John hears every single word that the clerk is saying. So even if he wasn't already aware, this is the latest moment he would figure out what Rosemary is doing.
I honestly think that the solution to this would be don't call the police in front of the person you're calling the police for. So if it were for the clerk to go in the back room and do it there, which I understand why he didn't, or wait for them to leave, which I kind of, yes, guess I understand, whatever. But doing it this way was very not smart.
I mean, the fact that we're in America and he has a fucking shotgun under the till is all we need to know about the personality of this clerk. He is going to sort the situation by himself or die trying, which he does.
There was also a sign on the front door that said no firearms inside allowed or something like that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that is a standard thing, that the owner is armed on the premises and everyone else may not be, especially at gas stations.
I have not experienced any of that, but then again, I haven't been to that many gas stations in America, so.
I just watch a lot of shit television, so that is where that information comes from. And while all of this is happening and John is then realizing what is going on and trying to remove Rosemary, I actually think that John looks a bit disappointed in Rosemary. He genuinely considers her, as he has repeatedly said and continues on saying, that he genuinely considers her a good person.
Why? I'm not really sure.
Because he sees people different than we do. And I'm pretty sure that is an effect of the Ruby. And so I actually think that he's genuinely a bit disappointed in Rosemary. And I think that this disappointment plays into her later on not leaving. This is the moment where there is a certain type of connection established between the two. Because she is a genuinely good person. She is better than she should be, and she is better to him than she should be.
That we can agree on, the last part. I don't think I'm going to be ever able to understand why she doesn't leave at the end, but we'll get to that, I suppose, because that was something that just stayed very... It just left a little weird taste in my mouth when I was watching that, because I just wasn't sure why.
I think because she needs to conquer the fear, because her point was people are afraid, and so she conquers the fear, which my hope is going to get mirrored later on in an episode when John needs to get over his selfishness. Because we get the paralleling people act out of selfishness, people act out of fear. She manages to not act out of fear. And so I would hope that down the line, John acts selfless.
Interesting theory. Sure would be interested to see him not be a selfish asshole.
I feel like this would be a perfect setup. I don't know if they're gonna deliver on that, but I do see the opportunity. We, of course, once again have the same situation as we do in the hospital, where technically John doesn't kill a single person, he doesn't lay a hand on anyone, but he also is fully aware that he is wearing the amulet, so he knows exactly what is gonna happen. So that is another potential philosophical debate. We can have 3-hour fights in the summoning episode.
Love that. Can't wait.
Oh, the sarcasm is dripping.
I just think that John really, 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 really loves saying, "I told you so," whether it is to a human being or something that used to be a human being.
Yep, so do I. And maybe that is why I have such a good time with John. I also really enjoy being technically correct, and so does John.
Well, now let's move on to a part that I enjoyed and you didn't, because it's going to be a much better time for me.
And a much worse time for me. We go into our final hell scene.
I feel like this is the second episode in a row where this is happening, right? That we are very opposite on the scenes.
Hey, at least one of us is enjoying every part of the episode, you know?
True that. So the scene is set for the biggest fight that I actually thought was going to be a fight until this point. I was like, that's going to be so cool to watch Lucifer and Dream actually fight. No, that's not going to happen. Great. It's going to be a contest of skills, confidence, and transformation. Whatever the fuck does that mean?
I also felt that was misleading, because from that description, I thought they were going to be shapeshifting. Proper shapeshifting.
I kind of thought so too.
And I wonder if it was a budget reason we didn't get that.
I didn't understand a lot of things until a certain moment. It took me a good while to understand the concept of what they were trying to do.
I mean, I still have complaints, so
I'm glad that I got there. I'm glad that I managed to realize the name of the episode being a thing before it became relevant, about 4 seconds before it became relevant. But alas, I win.
Okay, I love that. Before we go into the fight, I need to point out one thing. Did you catch that Murphy's realm is being referred to as the realm of sleep? Which is so much less cool sounding than the realms of nightmares.
And he introduced himself as the Lord of Nightmares at the beginning to get some street cred. I got it, I got
and
it.
I was like, seriously, like the realm of sleep. It's like, yawn. I was here for that.
This actually goes really, really well with my first line of notes on this scene. It doesn't seem like anybody respects him anywhere in this realm. Although, not just in this realm, in general. Because Johanna was also like, yeah, whatever, I don't care. I'm gonna send this fucker to hell. And she's better for it.
And Lucien also didn't listen to him and sent Matthew after him. And Matthew also doesn't listen to him. So at the current count, no one is respecting him at all.
I love that you went through the counting on your fingers. Like, at this count, nobody is respecting him.
I think the only person that showed him a modicum of respect was Abel. Literally the only person.
Which is sad.
Yeah.
It is sad.
Yeah.
See, he is also being referred to as the king of what used to be the realm of dreams or something like that. Something that makes it feel like it is a thing of past.
It is in shambles.
Yeah. Which, again, very interesting.
But while all of this is happening, at some point, Dream is preparing for a moment and hunkering down to talk to Matthew. And this is literally the first moment where we see Dream not being a selfish dick, because he tells Matthew to fuck off. And Matthew's like, hell no, give me a reason at least. And the reason is that if Morpheus actually does lose this fight, he does not want to leave Lucien without a word again. And this is the first time Morpheus acknowledges he done fucked up in the past and he should not repeat. So maybe there is still hope for the dick.
Well, it is certainly a step towards the right direction. I do appreciate that he is finally trying.
A tiny shuffle. It's not a step yet, it's a shuffle.
Just a little shimmy.
Yes.
I'm having a really good time imagining Dream shimmy.
Oh God, can you imagine Tom Sturridge as Morpheus shimmying? It would look so awkward. I do not feel that Dream has a rhythm.
I think that's a great idea.
Oh my God.
Of course, Lucy is coming back and being the most condescending self yet again.
Oh God,
I am living for this. It's so good. And this is where the challenge started.
Yes, and Lucifer gets to start. And I already hate the first choice because even I could think of so many things that beat the direwolf on every level. Why would you start with that?
I think that they both know that this is gonna be a gradual thing. And why not start small so you can enjoy the triumph? It's gonna be a sweeter victory if you're gonna just burn them and destroying them step by step.
I just felt that a direwolf was a very boring, obvious thing to take, which is also very easy and obvious to beat. So I was disappointed by the lack of creativity of Lucifer.
So this whole challenge concept, it starts and we get the imagery for the first time. And I was like, this is boring.
Yeah.
What is this about? And then Lucifer gets hurt. There is actual blood coming out. And I was like, ooh, this is cool. They're getting hurt by the other's invention. This is going to be interesting. And then we come in with the hunter and then the snake.
The poisonous serpent, which, come on, it's fucking Lucifer. A poisonous serpent, aka a snake? Yeah.
Incredible. Worked out really well. Then we get the bird of prey on Dream's side. Keep attacking each other.
Did you see Mazikeen's face when Dream picks the bird of prey? Because in my opinion, you see genuine worry for Lucifer on her face, which goes into my earlier point. Lucifer should not be that easily defeatable in this fight as the second powerful creature. And Mazikeen should not be that worried for Lucifer.
Well, the only thing I can build upon is the relationship between Maze and Lucy in the Luciverse.
Oh, Maze in the comics is also very, very close to Lucifer.
Which I assume, and there is a very strong bond, and Maze is very protective of, I'm assuming, each version of Lucifer. So that doesn't surprise me, but I did miss it. So thank you for pointing that out. And then we go to the Bacterium.
Which, I was here for it. Finally, some actual creativity. The Bacterium just deteriorating and eating up the bird of prey. And then Morpheus's face. Beautiful.
And this is an attack. And then Dream strategy changes. I think he needed to heal himself.
Yeah, but how is a world beating or stronger or surviving the Bacterium? The Bacterium is just going to exist there.
I am a world, space floating, life nurturing. I think the life nurturing part is the important part.
Yeah, but the Bacterium is also life. So I genuinely did not understand this. We don't have to harp on this because there are many things that don't make sense. But the world countering the Bacterium is the one that makes the least sense to me.
And then we have the Nova. So again, attack, and a universe is again defense instead of counterattack.
Again, the universe is not a defense against the Nova. It's like, yes, you can destroy one world, but the universe has many worlds, so the others are going to survive. So I, as Lucifer, would simply go, I am uncountable Novas destroying every single part of your universe. It's like, mirror, mirror, mirror. You know, this is how this game feels to me.
No, I don't think so, because I think that the point of this, if I understand it correctly, and I probably don't, it needs to be bigger. It needs to be something that can survive the thing. And yes, Lucifer could have gone with, I am the same amount of Novas as you have planets in your universe, but that's not really winning. I feel like it's just like a childish, oh, mirror, mirror, mirror.
Fuck you a million times. Fuck you a million times plus infinity.
Plus one.
Plus infinity, because then I have one.
Yeah, but that's not how this game works.
To me, it did, because I probably didn't understand it.
Because, no, but the thing is that the anti-life would have still destroyed the Novas. So I think that Lucifer just didn't want to leave anything to a chance and just chose to go with the anti-life over the universe, because there is nothing that can beat anti-life.
Anti-life Beast of Judgment, Dark at the End of Everything.
It's the end.
Yes. And as obvious as I found that hope is going to be the answer, I also say no. When there is nothing left and no living life, then there also is no hope. Sorry.
Well, that means that there's probably still the creator though, right?
Entry life, Beast of Judgment, Dark at the End of Everything is there is nothing left. So if there is nothing left, there is no hope. Also no creator. So obviously we get the struggle after the anti-life before we get the hope. And I am sorry, I hated this so much that Morpheus is basically losing until Matthew comes there and is like, oh no, I'm giving you a pep talk. It killed the entire moment for me. Morpheus should have survived this without external interference. And technically, he lost, in my opinion, because there was external interference.
I think that you're giving Matthew a lot of credit there.
Do you think Morpheus would have continued and won without Matthew talking to him?
Yes.
Then this needs to go on the list because I genuinely think no.
I think that it wasn't about what Matthew was saying. It was about the fact that he is there.
Yeah, doesn't change my point. Without Matthew there, he would have lost. And that killed everything about it for me.
Okay. Now, I have realized that this was going to be hope.
4 seconds before he says hope.
Yeah.
I'm so proud of you.
So happy about that. I was so happy about that. I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. Typey, typey, typey.
It's like we not ever had the fucking conversation about fucking hope. And we had this conversation at the podcast.
Mm-hmm. And I love how much Lucifer hates that hope is the one thing, because there is no counter attack to hope. There is none. And the only reason Lucifer admits that is because Lucifer too has hope. Lucifer too has dreams.
So hopes and dreams are very different. And I challenge that there is a thing, actually there's two things, that would defeat hope. And those are doubt and despair. And at least despair is one of the endless. So that's the point.
I don't think that those would be powerful enough to destroy hope. There is always going to be hope. Every single moment of humanity is based on the fact that there is always hope. Things can be different.
Yeah, until there's no hope because there is too much despair. And then people do give up. People do give up. Like, it's a thing. People do give up and then they don't have any hope.
People give up. Society does not.
Pass pro toto. If it works in a singular instance, it also can work in a universal scale. That is my opinion.
I don't think so.
But it is claimed here that there is nothing to defeat hope. And even more so, it is claimed that hell wouldn't work without hope. Because if the inmates...
Without dream.
Yeah, but it is basically used as stand-in for hope. Because they dream of heaven. Because they hope at one point they are going to be able to go there. So without hope, hell as a torture place would not work. Because they need hope that it might change in the future to endure. And without enduring, there is no torture.
Exactly.
Yeah, so take away the option to go to heaven, and then there is no hope. Then there's only despair.
That's not necessarily true, because if you take away the option, they will still hope that the option is there and you're just being told.
That's just making it very convoluted. Before we go into the whole people in hell fucking dream of whatever, we get the reveal with the hope moment. And of course, we get a beautiful frame visual of Dream saying the word hope. And as much as I loathe the answer, it is visually very well done. Because this is also one of the moments he smiles. It's actually the only moment I actively realized he smiles.
It's a very different smile to the previous smiles.
And then we have the whole interaction and everything. And Corazon is being called to give up the helm. And he's being an idiot and refuses, which was bound to go wrong. I mean, what did he think would happen?
I think that this is because the items have certain power over the creatures that hold them.
Mezzikeen takes the helmet off him, throws him into the pit with the other demons. We don't see him again, so who knows if he survives that fall or if demons even can die just by falling down tall heights. And then, of course, we get the important quote with, "What power would hell have if those here imprisoned would not be able to dream of heaven?" Which is one of the, I think, most quoted lines from Sandman Season 1. Oh, no! Wait, before we get that, Morpheus calls Lucifer honorable. And for some reason, Lucifer is incredibly offended by that, which surprised me.
Yeah, there might be some sort of history of Lucifer being not called honorable and then Lucifer embracing not being honorable and creating hell and being very happy there. I don't know. I'm just making this up as I go because I don't know enough of this backstory of this specific setting to guess why Lucifer was so pissed off about that.
But it was very visible. So at the end, Morpheus takes the helm and leaves and basically instantly puts on the fucking helmet, which I was very much here for because that was kind of the point. And I also, to be honest, expected him to just keep wearing it. So when we move into the container where the ruby is held and he instantly takes the helm off again, I was honestly disappointed. It made no sense.
Disappointed. I mean, he still is in the possession of the helm. I think that the dramatic light of the ruby being broken on the very sharp edges of Tom Sturridge's face.
I understand it visually, but technically it makes no sense. The first time we saw Morpheus in the world of humanity is when he hunts down the Corinthian and he is wearing his helmet in that. So my presumption was that when Dream goes jaywalking in the human realm, he is actively wearing his helmet. So it made no sense to me that he literally 5 seconds after getting his fucking helm back easily takes it off again.
I don't know, maybe he wants to see the ruby with his own eyes for the first time when they reunite.
It was just weird to me. It's like, hey, I got this bag! And now I carry it under my arm. It's like, what?
It was very, very beautifully done. And this is a moment where I get proven wrong because I did not actually believe John when he said he altered the ruby.
But he did. And he did it strongly.
I thought that it was a game that he was trying to play on his mother and in order for her to bring him to the ruby. And I said that in the previous episode when this was relevant. Now this brings me to a very interesting question. How the fuck did he manage to alter a ruby that belongs to the Dream of the Endless? How does a human being do that?
Because the ruby makes dreams come true. And within dreams, possibilities are endless.
I wasn't looking for a philosophical answer. I will take it.
It wasn't a philosophical answer. It was a fucking play on Dream of the Endless.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. I meant more specifically, I would love to know how mechanically he managed to alter the ruby.
John's biggest nightmare was that someone would be able to take the ruby away from him, and he learned how to use the ruby to proactively make his dreams come true. So he dreamed of a way to fix, in quotation marks, the ruby. And in a way, the ruby taught, or must have taught, John how to do this. Because it makes dreams come true. How technically, like detail-wise, it worked? No fucking clue, because make it up as you go, you know?
This makes a lot more sense to me, thank you very much. This idea of having a dream that the ruby will not be used by anybody else, and then the dream coming true, that is acceptable.
Good. And we have a knocked out Dream and Matthew lying in a corner, thankfully in a way that later on John will not see them and take the helm as well.
The question is, I was worried about that, but seeing John's reaction when he sees the ruby, I don't think that he would have noticed them if they were in front of him.
I don't think he would have cared.
He doesn't care about anything but the ruby. He is extremely hyper-focused, and he doesn't even question the fact that the ruby is no longer in the box that he left it in.
No, because it doesn't matter. So we switch over to the car. Rosemary is driving him to the container and he's getting out. And she is not instantly driving away, which, yes, fucking weird.
I don't understand this and I will never understand this.
We will talk about this in the future because I do hope that this is a paralleling foreshadowing. And when he enters the container and he picks up the ruby, I wrote down, I am curious how the two amulets will get along. And not even 5 seconds later, he fucking hands over the fucking amulet of fucking protection to fucking Rosemary. And I was like, wait, what? I did not see that coming at all.
Absolutely no way I would have ever seen this coming.
Also, his fucking mom gave that to him. Fuck you, John. I know he doesn't care, and it makes perfect sense, but also, she died to give this to you. Yeah.
And without it, he would never be able to get back to the ruby, so on that level, I think that he appreciates the sacrifice, but on that level and that level only.
Yeah, and he got the ruby, so whatever.
He's reunited with his fucking stone.
And so, John also does ask Rosemary why she is still here, and she is incredibly sweet in this moment when she is basically like, I also don't really know, but if you're hurting me, please do not hurt my dog. Which, precious, precious Rosemary.
I mean, that's cute, but like, also if he kills her right there, the dog's gonna be in the middle of nowhere with a fucking psycho.
Because I'm a horrible person, I worry that at any point Susie is going to play fight with Rosemary and the amulet is gonna read it as an attack and just explode the dog.
Yep, that's gonna happen now. I can't unsee it.
You're welcome.
And this is how Susie dies. Thank you very much. Isn't it interesting that she names everything that's dear to her starting with an S? Rosemary, Samantha, Sarah, Susie.
I'm pretty sure that is deliberate.
Is Susie her third daughter that she accidentally turned into a dog?
Is she actually a witch? Yay!
It's something that comes up because I don't really understand why else she would be so good with John, and I don't understand. Now she has the amulet and everything's gonna go shit-faced, and I'm so full of anxiety. Yet again, we are completely fucked. Everybody's gonna die.
Because it gets so much worse. Now that John walks off, he says he's going to save the world. And given the fact that he's the one saying that, I'm pretty sure the world is fucked.
Literally, my notes are, I have my ruby, the ruby makes dreams come true, and I will use it to save the world. Yes, we are absolutely fucked. This is over.
Yep.
So many familiar characters, but different in this episode. I am loving this. Lucifer and Mazikeen better be back because I want to see more of this version. The John side of the episode gave me nothing but anxiety. I literally am struggling to cope. I am so scared of what he's planning to do and what's gonna happen with Rosemary now that she has the amulet. Dream finally showed some backbone and real power, made some good decisions, and showed even more humanity, revealing he is able to love, at least according to himself. Either way, he now has 2 out of 3, but something tells me that the ruby isn't gonna be as easy. Looks like our amazing one ring theory may have been wrong.
Okay, I am going to repeat a lot of things I said in the episode. I am so over Matthew. I really need this raven to fucking die or to fuck off or to whatever. I am tired of his pure existence. I hate the exposition he is obviously being used for. I hate how relevant he's being made for no reason whatsoever. And no, I do not care that Matthew is also in the comics. Do not at me. Again, just like last episode, I very much enjoyed John's storyline. He keeps surprising me and he keeps making everything very tense, which is something I enjoy. Yes, I am weird, but I like being made uncomfortable. I am very curious if we'll see more of Rosemary down the line, since she now has the freaking amulet of protection. As for our main story of retrieving the helm, it was whelming. Lucifer explicitly is described as the second most powerful creature in the universe and starts their creative battle with a dire wolf. That is just sad. Plus, how is there nothing that beats hope? Despair, also coincidentally one of the Endless, should kill hope, or Doubt, which I don't think is one of the Endless, should be at least a worthy contender. In the comics, it makes a lot more sense because their Dream does fight the demon Corazon, not Lucifer themselves. But to portray Lucifer Morningstar this uncreative and bumbling, fuck no. Also, Gwendolyn Christie's face acting does not work for me at all. Visually, she worked quite well for me, especially on the posters, but in the episode itself, no. And now we have the final item that Dream apparently cannot use anymore because John changed it. A fucking vanilla mortal fucked up the fancy Dream ruby so badly that Morpheus cannot even touch it. How is that even possible? It's getting more and more ridiculous, and I'm struggling to keep cheering for Dream, especially when we get yet another example of him being a dick. And to make matters worse, not even a glimpse of the Corinthian in this episode. So I say next and hope for the best. I do hope you enjoyed at least our coverage of the episode more than I enjoyed the actual episode, because as usual, there was a lot of disagreement. If you want to hear more about our disagreements, fights, and debates, you can do so by becoming our Patreon over at patreon.com/TAOTpodcast, because there are hours upon hours of bonus material and we appreciate the support.
You can also find us on social media. We are on Twitter, we are on Instagram, we are on Blue Sky, super active obviously, and we also have an email address, sandman@taot-podcast.com. You can reach us there, or you can just leave us a review and recommend us to your friends. And with that,
bye!